but he's pretty sure he does. The fiends reach the cabin and slip from view inside it.
Maybe they're devil worshippers, Johanna says.
The bikers reappear behind the cabin and pass a bottle. Jesse hears a rustle and turns to find Edgar on his feet again.
Those sons of bitches are going to do us in, he says, and sets off for the car at a run.
Jesse throws an arm around his neck and drags him to his knees. Edgar twists and turns, trying to free himself, extra strong because he's scared.
Easy, Jesse croons. Easy.
His brother bucks a few more times, then collapses, breathing hard. Jesse strokes him like he would a spooked horse.
We're safe up here, he says. All you have to do is keep quiet.
Give him the girl, Edgar says.
We're not giving them the girl, Jesse says.
He spies a small cave at the base of the boulder, a niche barely visible behind a creosote bush.
Look, he says, an Indian hideout.
Edgar lifts his head, intrigued.
They'll never find you in there.
Edgar crawls to the cave and backs into it.
Can you see me? He says.
Not a hair, Jesse says.
There's room for you.
I'll keep watch. Soon as it's clear, I'll come for you. When Jesse gets back to where he left Johanna, she's gone. He spots movement below, on the overlook. The girl is sneaking toward the trail that leads to the cabin. The fiends are still on the ledge behind the ruin. One of them has a gun. The baby starts crying again as Jesse races down to retrieve Johanna. She's crouched at the edge of the overlook, straining to make out what's happening below, but the cabin blocks the fiends from view. She flinches, startled, when Jesse appears out of the darkness and kneels beside her.
Come with me, he whispers.
But then the click of a revolver's hammer on an empty chamber rings out. He and Johanna watch the cabin, holding their breaths. One of the fiends yells,
God damn it!
And another click rebounds off the surrounding hills. Jesse's worried. He and Johanna are on the path the fiends will use to return to their Harleys, and they'll see them as soon as they leave the cabin. He needs to move the girl now, while the bikers are occupied. He tugs her arm, but she frowns and pulls away.
The baby, she says.
A gun goes off, making them both jump. The child stops bawling mid-wail.
Oh my God, Johanna says.
What Jesse sees is Claudine. Claudine confused. Claudine terrified. He flashes back to her final moments, and when Johanna jumps up and starts down the trail to the cabin, he follows without hesitation, thinking only that she'll not die in front of him like Claudine did. They're completely exposed on the mountainside, no cover at all, and flying blind, their view of the fiends still obstructed by the cabin. Jesse catches up to Johanna.
Me first, he mouths,
and squeezes past her to take the lead. She rests a hand on his shoulder to steady herself, and he goes as slowly as he dares. They take cover behind a stunted Palo Verde tree when they reach the ledge. The baby cries again, the wails coming from inside the cabin. Jesse sees the shorter, stockier fiend through a gap in the wall, facing away from them. There's no sign of the tall one. Jesse twists to look over his shoulder, worried he might be creeping up on them, but the only thing moving is a sheet of plastic caught on a rock. He turns back to find Johanna crawling across the open ground between the Palo Verde and the cabin. He starts after her, then thinks better of it, staying hidden and keeping an eye on the fiend out back instead. Johanna pauses when she reaches the doorway. Jesse waves for her to return, but she shakes her head and continues into the cabin. The next thing Jesse knows, he's in the doorway, watching her grope for the baby in the darkness. He sees where the child is lying, still closed up in the sack, but doesn't dare risk directing Johanna to it, not with the shorter fiend 10 feet beyond, grinning down at the body of his companion on the ground beside him.
You lose, motherfucker,
the shorter fiend says as the taller one sits up and shakes his head. Jesse wonders whether he should grab Johanna and flee or rush the bikers. The choice is made for him when Johanna finds the sack, snatches it up, and crawls back toward the door. The short fiend pulls a knife.
To the victor go the spoils.
Jesse yanks Johanna to her feet and hurries her to the Palo Verde. They drop behind it as the fiend enters the cabin. Finding the sack missing, he yells, Where's the kid? Any second now, he'll spot them. The best Jesse can do is give Johanna a fighting chance. Go, he says. She hugs the sack and runs up the trail toward the overlook. The shorter fiend sees this and starts after her. Jesse pops the blade of the stiletto he carries. He covers the yard of the cabin in 2 leaps, ducks when the fiend slashes with his knife, and plants the stiletto in the biker's barrel chest, leaving it there when the man sinks to his knees and flops onto his back. The tall fiend staggers through the cabin, brandishing his own knife. Jesse blocks an overhead stab and punches him in the face. The biker's legs wobble. Jesse hits him again. He drops his knife, and Jesse dives for it. The man is too quick. He falls on the blade, covering it with his body. Jesse tries to roll him over, but he grabs Jesse's hand, twists it, and snaps a bone in his wrist. The pain makes Jesse woozy. He runs out the door, stepping over the shorter biker's body. Johanna is halfway to the overlook when he catches her. He takes her arm and forces her to speed up. The tall fiend is on his feet. He recovers his knife and steps outside the cabin where he sees Jesse and Johanna scrambling up the mountain. He bends over his partner and pulls Jesse's stiletto out of him before giving chase. Jesse and Johanna near the overlook, the tall fiend closing on them. Jesse hands Johanna the keys to the Grand Prix, meaning to stand and fight. Even if he goes down, he might hold the bikers off long enough for the girl to escape. "Get to the car and go," he says. "Don't stop. Don't look back." Johanna continues up the trail as Jesse picks up a rock and turns to face the tall fiend's attack. He's smaller than the man, lighter, and he hopes faster. The biker's knife flashes like a shooting star as he raises it, running full tilt. Jesse fakes like he's going to meet the man upright, but ducks in the instant before the fiend crashes into him and jams his shoulder into his belly. All the wind goes out of the biker, and he doubles over. Jesse brings the rock down on the back of his head, hitting him again and again until he feels the man's skull give way. Somehow managing to keep standing, the biker staggers backward. Jesse rushes him, only to run into a whistling haymaker that smashes into his temple and sends him to the ground, cockeyed, ears ringing. The fiend lifts his knife, but as he's about to bring it down, his eyes roll back and he topples, the blows from the rock finally taking their toll. Jesse looks toward the cabin. The shorter fiend has healed enough to sit. He spies Jesse, struggles to his feet, and stumbles to the trail. Defying dizziness and pain, Jesse grabs the taller fiend's blade. He tilts the man's head back to expose his throat and begins to saw. Blood spurts, slicking the handle of the knife. Jesse tightens his grip and keeps cutting. Soon all that's keeping the head attached is the spine. Jesse wedges the knife between two vertebrae, bears down, and twists the head free. He's startled when the man turns to ash. He knew it would happen, but he's never dusted a rover before. The shorter fiend is coming quickly up the trail. Jesse dashes the last 50 feet to level ground and turns with the dusted biker's knife in his hand. The shorter fiend plows into him like a bull before he can get set. He goes flying and lands hard, but pops up ready to fight. The fiend spits as he approaches. He's smaller than the dusted one, but beefier and has a bigger knife. He tosses it in the air and catches it by the handle, showing off. There's a grin on his face, but his eyes are rage-fueled furnaces. "Greetings, brother," he says, sarcastic. "How long have you been tailing us?" "I've never seen you before," Jesse says. "Bullshit. It's the truth. Were you stealing the kid to feed on, or were you trying to save it? Does it matter?" "No, no, it doesn't." Everything inside Jesse wants to run, but he goes into a crouch and cocks his knife arm. The fiend charges, aiming to bowl him over again. Jesse drops and rolls out of his path. As he passes, Jesse slashes one of his calves to the bone. The man stumbles but regains his balance. He shuffles sideways, circling Jesse, stalling while the wound mends. Jesse turns to keep him in front of him. He spots an opening, darts in, feints right, goes left, and stabs the fiend in the side. The fiend strikes at the same time, jabbing his knife into Jesse's upper back, the blade puncturing one of Jesse's lungs. Jesse lurches out of reach, coughing blood. The fiend limps toward him, but Jesse can't work up the momentum to run. Every time he moves, it's like he's being stabbed again. He waves his knife. The fiend slaps it away and raises his own blade. Jesse bows his head to await the strike, but it doesn't come. The fiend grunts, and Jesse looks up to see that Edgar, twice as big as the biker and twice as strong, has him in a chokehold. "Don't let go," Jesse says. He picks up his knife and dashes toward Edgar and the fiend. His haste makes him careless. The fiend lifts both feet off the ground and, supported by Edgar, kicks with all his might. Jesse takes the blow in the stomach and falls backward. The fiend turns his attention to Edgar, stabbing blindly over his shoulder. Edgar bellows in pain but keeps choking him. The biker weakens, can't keep his knife up. The blade slips from his fingers, and he sags in Edgar's arms. Jesse runs at him again. His thrust is deflected by a rib, though, and with a final desperate spasm, the fiend snaps his head back and slams his skull into Edgar's face. Edgar releases the biker and presses his hands to his broken, gushing nose. The fiend pauses, panting, thinking, then says,
"You know you're a dead man, don't you? Wherever you go, we'll find you."
He turns and bolts for the edge of the overlook. Running full speed, he hurls himself off the precipice. Jesse, right behind, pulls up short. The fiend soars briefly out into the night, a black angel bound for the stars, before falling. He slams into the mountain 200 feet below and tumbles another 100 before finally skidding to a stop, a bloody sack of broken bones and ruptured guts. There's no easy way down to where he is to finish him off, so Jesse decides to flee. Edgar moans when he crouches beside him.
"You all right?"
"I got blood all on my shirt."
"I'll get you a new one."
"Mickey Mouse?"
"Whatever you want. You did good, buddy."
Johanna watches wide-eyed from the thicket where the Grand Prix is hidden. The baby, freed from the sack, sucks one of her fingers. "Get in the car," Jesse calls to her, but she doesn't move. He tells Edgar to come with him. They walk to the fiend's motorcycles. He takes hold of one and has Edgar grab the other. They roll them to the edge of the overlook and push them off, sending them crashing down the side of the mountain. Edgar whoops and pounds his chest like a gorilla. Jesse hurries him to the car. Johanna backs away as they approach. She's just watched Jesse cut off a man's head and seen that man disappear.
"Please don't hurt me," she says.
"I'm trying to save your life," Jesse replies.
"I want to get out of here."
"So do I, and I want to get the baby out of here too, so let's go."
Johanna moves cautiously to the Grand Prix, keeping plenty of distance between her and the brothers. She slides into the back seat, and Jesse gets behind the wheel. Edgar climbs in on the passenger side. Checking constantly for more fiends, Jesse backs out of the thicket, squeals onto the road, and races down the mountain. Chapter 14.
"Jesse won't let me hold the baby. I ask him twice till he tells me shut up. It's in Johanna's lap in the back seat. I reach my hand out and it grabs my finger. I ask if it's a boy or a girl, and Johanna says it's a girl.
'What's her name?' I ask.
'I don't know,' Johanna says. 'She wants to take the baby to the police.' 'No police,' Jesse says. 'We'll drop her at a hospital.' Johanna's shaking. 'Drop me there too,' she says, 'please.' I promise I won't say anything about what I saw." Jesse looks at her in the mirror and says, "It's not us you've got to worry about, it's that biker. He runs with a gang called the Fiends. He'll be coming back to life and him and the rest of them will be after me for dusting that man and you for grabbing the baby." The child makes a noise and Johanna lays it over her shoulder. "They won't find me," she says. "Phoenix is a big city. Not big enough," Jesse says. "There's a story about someone stealing one of their motorcycles. They chased the man for 2 years, and when they finally caught up to him, killed him and the woman he was traveling with, and 5 other people, 2 of them children who happened to be in the house. That's how they are." Johanna looks like she's going to cry.
"What are they?" she says. "What are you?"
Jesse tells her most of it. How we can't go out in the day. How we heal when we get hurt. How we ain't never going to die. "It's too much talking, and I know it already. I want to play pinball. They got space time at the bowling alley and quick draw and fireball. I'm good at all of them."
Johanna asks Jesse if he kills people and drinks their blood like the fiends do. He tells her no. He tells her me and him are a different kind of rover. He's lying, but I don't squeal. Me and him have secrets. You gotta be careful. You gotta keep your mouth shut.
Johanna sits back and strokes one of her braids. "My dad'll know what to do," she says. "He'll help me."
"What are you going to tell him?" Jesse says. "Monsters are after you. He'll think you're crazy. And if the fiends find out where your family lives, they'll kill them too."
"So what should I do?" Johanna says. "Get out of town for a couple months at least," Jesse says. "For good, if possible. You were talking about going to California. Go now. I don't have any money," Johanna says, "and my car's a hunk of junk." We're back in the city. Out the window, there's a giant holding a giant tire. There's a building that looks like a castle and another with a blinking antenna on top. There's a Ford pickup painted like it's on fire.
"What are you going to do?" Johanna asks Jesse.
"We're getting out of here tonight," he says, "driving as far as we can before daylight." The baby starts bawling again. She's burning up, Johanna says. We gotta get her to a doctor. Jesse says we need to clean up first. We stop at a Gulf station and he takes me to the bathroom. He scrubs the blood off his face and makes me do the same. Johanna and the baby ain't in the car when we get back. She's run off, I say. Quiet, Jesse says. He waits, jingling coins, and whispers okay when Johanna comes out of the ladies' room. She gives him directions to the hospital. He parks away from the lights. She goes to get out, but Jesse stops her. Better if I do it, he says. He asks for her shirt, because his is bloody. Johanna thinks on it and takes off her top. Her brassiere is pink and shiny. A girl I fed on in Kansas City had one just like it. Jesse wearing Johanna's shirt makes me laugh. You sure are pretty, Miss Jesse, I say. He gets out of the car, takes the baby from Johanna, and runs off across the parking lot. An ambulance drives past quiet, but with its red and blue lights going. I ask Johanna, does she want me to sing Neil Young? She says, no thanks, watching where Jesse went. Don't worry, I say, he's real smart. Jesse comes running back and strips off Johanna's shirt. We drive out of the hospital so fast, I take hold of the dash. Jesse gave the baby to a nurse. She didn't have any questions, Johanna says. I imagine she did, Jesse says, but I got the hell out of there before she could ask him. Everyone's quiet for a spell. Johanna lights a cigarette. Can I go with you? She says. We aren't going to Los Angeles, Jesse says. Anywhere'll do, Johanna says. I'll get a bus from wherever we wind up. We can't have a woman with us. They're bad luck, Jesse always says. He don't even like Abby. But I can see he's mulling it. I poke him and shake my head. He tells me to quit. Bad luck, I whisper. He don't pay me no mind. We'll drop you in Denver, he says to Johanna, but you have to do exactly what I tell you while you're with us. We can't even stop at your place. Anything you need, we'll pick up along the way. Fine, Johanna says. We get to the motel and go inside. Johanna sits on Jesse's bed while he showers the rest of the blood off him. You want to play nickel knock? I ask her. You need 3 cards that add up to 31. We can play for money or candy. She shakes her head no. You couldn't shut her up before, and now she's got nothing to say. Abby's in a corner watching her with hate in her eyes. Jesse comes out of the bathroom and says it's my turn. Hot water, he says. I scrub and scrub. Blood don't come off easy. The water's pink going down the drain. After I dry off, I do a peek into the room. Jesse's sitting with Johanna on the bed. His arms around her and he's talking sweet. She smiles but won't laugh. The little devil pipes up. Him and her going off together, gonna leave you all alone, he says. Goosebumps rise on my arms. I yell for Jesse to help me get dressed. Stop playing around, he says when he comes in. You know how to put your clothes on. Don't leave me, I say. What are you talking about, he says. You got Johanna now, I say. We're driving her to Denver, that's all, he says. You know I can smell a lie, I say. I'm not going anywhere without you, he says. He carries our grips out and puts them in the trunk of the Grand Prix. I give Abby a bowl of meow mix and stand by while she crunches it. How old's your kitty? Johanna asks me. 25 or thereabouts, I say. That's ancient for a cat, she says. I turned her, I say. What? Johanna says. I turned her into a rover, I say. She starts to cry. Jesse comes in and asks what's wrong. You changed the cat, Johanna says. Jesse gives me a look like he wants to kill me and sits down to sweet talk her again. I'm glad she's crying. The more you cry, the less you have to piss. We set off when she quiets. Pretty soon there's no more buildings, no more cars, no more town. Everything's dark except for the speed meter inside and headlights outside. Jesse checks the mirror over and over. Johanna falls asleep laying across the back seat. I sing to myself, real quiet, Mama's song. I would not die in summer when music's on the breeze and soft, delicious murmurs float ever through the trees.
Chapter 15. June 27th, 1976, 10 p.m. For the third time today, I'm putting pen to paper. This time to set down what happened in just the last hour while it's fresh in my mind. I stayed here in the Econoline after my last entry earlier today, reading my Bible and trying to figure out my next move. Had cold chili for dinner. Shortly after dark, As I was about to settle down to sleep, Czarnecki came out of the cabin, mush-mouthed drunk.
"There's something else I need to show you," he said.
I got out of the van reluctantly and followed him to his pickup. He climbed into the camper, undid the locks on the crate, and opened it. The kid had been chained inside since last night and looked like hell. Dark circles ringed his eyes, and his bones would have torn his thin skin if he'd moved too quickly. Czarnecki backed out of the camper and stood beside me.
"Come on,"
he snapped at the kid. "I need," the kid began.
"I know what you fucking need."
The kid lifted himself slowly out of the crate. He took a second to reset his balance, then stepped onto the bumper and down to the ground. Czarnecki had his .45 in his hand.
"The shed," he said.
The kid staggered to his prison, walked inside, and yanked the string to turn on the bulb. The light it threw was the color of a flophouse bedsheet. The kid sat on the cot and fastened his ankle chain to the bolt in the floor. Czarnecki passed the .45 to me.
"If he tries anything, put a bullet between his eyes," he said.
I qualified for a marksmanship badge in the Army, but that was 20 years ago. I was as likely to hit him as the kid if I had to shoot. He drew a hunting knife from a sheath on his belt. Grabbing a bottle of rubbing alcohol off a shelf, he doused the blade and pulled up the sleeve of his coveralls. The inside of his forearm bore a series of short, crosswise scars, 20 or so, some old, some freshly healed. They followed the arm's main vein from elbow to wrist. He laid the blade on a patch of unmarred skin and sliced into it. Blood dribbled from the cut. Stepping to the kid, he held out the arm. The kid grabbed it and pressed his mouth to the wound.
"You have to give him a little every now and then to keep him going," Czarnecki said. "He'll tell you he needs it once a month, but I make him go too. Doesn't matter to me how lousy he gets to feeling. I want him weak."
"How long has this been going on?" I said.
"I trapped him in 67, so 9 years or so. Me and Mr. Otto had a couple of others, but he's lasted longest."
The image of the old man offering his blood to the kid, the sucking sound, the smell of shit and sweat that clung to the concrete walls, this and the other horrors of the past few days hit me all at once. The urge to flee was powerful, but I was so woozy I barely made it to the doorway before sinking to the ground in a stupor.
"You look like you've seen a monster," Czarnecki said with a laugh.
He was a foolish man, or, I don't know, maybe a brave one, joking like that while I was holding the gun. Maybe he's taken my measure and decided I'm not the kind that'll lash out no matter how far I'm pushed. Maybe he's had my number since he approached me in the parking lot, and I agreed to follow him here. In any case, I didn't shoot him. I sat against the door jamb and stared out at the light spilling from the cabin, at the trees against the sky, at the stars sharp as needles. I inhaled deeply, trying to flush the filth from my lungs and refill them with clean air. The sound of a scuffle made me turn back into the shed. Czarnecki was struggling to pull his arm away from the kid.
"Let go, motherfucker," he growled.
I stood and pointed the .45. "Should I shoot?" I said.
"Should he?" Czarnecki yelled. "Should he?"
The kid released him and backed away. He ran a finger over the blood on his lips, sucked it clean, and showed his gold tooth in a defiant smile, then stretched out on the cot and rolled to face the wall. Czarnecki turned off the bulb, and we stepped outside. He closed the door and locked it.
"Might be time to get a new hound," he said, loud enough so the kid could hear. "You can't keep a biting dog."
He pressed the handkerchief to the cut. I held the .45 out to him.
"Bring it inside," he said.
"I'm all wrung out," I said.
5 minutes, he said. Sit with me while I patch this nick.
I could barely keep my eyes open, but I followed him to the cabin. He poured himself some whiskey and brought out a cigar box first aid kit. After painting the cut with iodine, he asked me to lay a bandage over it. My fingers brushed the scars on his arm, waxy pink worms spaced regularly as fence posts, and I pulled my hand away, repulsed. He smiled and lifted his other sleeve to show more scars.
"My rosary," he said. "Each a mystery to be contemplated."
"You're religious?" I said.
"I was, then I wasn't. But I might be trending back. You?"
"I believe in God," I said. "I believe Jesus Christ died for our sins."
"How do rovers fit into your system?"
"There are demons in the Bible."
"Demons," he said. "So you won't have any problem killing them?"
It's a question I haven't answered for myself yet, so I wiggled out of answering it for him by replying, "That's not what I said." Czarnecki leaned back in his chair.
"Here's one way to look at it," he said. "Before Jesus, you got rid of sin through sacrifice. For every sin you committed, you slaughtered an animal and offered it up to God. Now, if one little lamb erased a wrong from your record, imagine how many a demon must clear. You'll be in the black in no time."
Too tired to respond, I rubbed my eyes with my palms.
"Sure you won't have a drink?" Czarnecki said.
"No drink," I said. Czarnecki sipped his.
"I don't understand why anybody would want to live forever anyway," he said. "Not even in heaven. When I die, I want to sleep for 1,000,000 years.
I was struck again by how frail he looks in repose. His hatred for the monsters he's hunted so long has dried him to brittle bones and leathery yellow flesh. In the right light, he looks dead already. The refrigerator clattered, spooking me, and I used the momentum from the jolt to get to my feet. Czarnecki didn't say anything when I walked out, didn't look up. Exhausted as I am, I was sure I'd drop off as soon as I hit the cot. My brain, though, keeps replaying what I saw in the shed. So I'm putting it down here, hoping, like a guilty criminal, that bearing my soul will ease my mind. And now, God, let me sleep. June 28, 1976, Bishop, California. After a long, rotten night, I finally dozed off as the sky lightened and the first birds woke. When I sat up 5 hours later, weariness still clung to me like a spider's web. But my mind was clearer, and I felt like I could put one foot in front of the other without falling. The banana in the cardboard box that serves as my pantry had gone black and gooey. Ants swarmed it, squeezing through a slit in the peel to get at the mush inside. The apple next to it was fine, so I cut that into quarters and ate it with spoonfuls of peanut butter and a cup of cold instant coffee. The day warmed quickly, and it was soon too hot to be reading my Bible in the van. I set up my chair in the shade outside and settled there. My eyes kept wandering to the shed, my thoughts to the creature that had been locked inside it for almost a decade. I snuffed a flicker of sympathy by imagining him hunched over Benny, the same way he'd hunched over Czarnecki, drinking his blood. I listened to two squirrels argue. I watched a thunderhead balloon on the horizon. I opened my Bible to a random page and dropped my finger to the text for guidance. The verse was no help. A list of names of the sons of Noah, the sons of Japheth, the sons of Gomer. All the while I kept expecting Czarnecki to step out of the cabin, snorting, spitting, and blowing smoke, but he never did. About noon, I walked over and called for him. There was no response. The cabin door was open, but the screen was closed. I climbed onto the porch and shouted again. Again, no answer. The flag hanging next to the door flapped once, loudly, like a whip cracking. A fat black horsefly circled and buzzed off toward the shed. Cupping my eyes, I peered through the screen, nose pressed to the mesh. A patch of sunlight lay on the empty bed like a brilliant quilt. Another spilled off the table onto the floor. The bright spots only made the rest of the room darker. I had to squint to penetrate the gloom. The first thing to come into focus was one of the chairs that had been next to the table. It lay on its back in front of the fireplace now. The rack that held the fireplace tools had toppled, too, and the poker, shovel, and broom were strewn across the hearth. I raised my eyes higher, dread a dark fizz in my chest, and there was Zernecki, 2 feet off the floor, dangling from a rope thrown over a roof beam. I rushed into the cabin, but it was too late. The old man was dead, had been for some time. One end of the rope was tied to a steel hook screwed into the wall. The other had been twisted into a noose. It wasn't an easy death. His tongue was nearly chewed through. "You son of a bitch," I said. He laid his burdens, the Rovers, Mr. Otto's crusade, the kid, on me, and I doubted I was strong enough to bear them. I came close to walking out to the van and driving off, close to turning my back on the whole nightmare and returning home. But I'm not that kind of man, and I think you know it, baby. I hope you do, anyway. It was too much to contemplate the big picture right then, so I focused on what was in front of me. Czarnecki's body had to be dealt with, and there'd be no police or coroners or funeral homes involved. Grabbing a knife from the kitchen, I cut the rope and lowered the corpse. It weighed almost nothing. I pulled the sleeping bag off the bed and zipped the body into it, found a wheelbarrow in the yard, and used that to move the bundle. Wildflowers grew at the base of the pine tree where I dug the grave, shoveling through duff to packed earth. I kept digging until I was waist deep in the hole, then rolled the body into it and recited what I could recall of the funeral prayer. Earth to earth, ashes to ashes, dust to dust. The sun was dropping fast by the time I'd refilled the grave and spread pine needles to cover my tracks. Back in the Econoline, I lay on my cot. I dreaded the internal battle I was sure was coming over what to do next, but got to sleep just like that and didn't wake until after dark. The kid turned to look at me when I opened the door to the shed. I stepped inside, put on the light, and threw him the keys. "Get up," I said, waving Zernecki's 45. "Where's the old man?" he said. I wasn't in the mood to explain. I pointed the gun at him and said, "We're leaving. Get yourself out to the camper." He detached his chain from the bolt, picked up his slop bucket, and shuffled to the truck. When he was sitting in the crate, I gave him a tuna sandwich. "Thanks, boss," he said. "Lie down," I said, and lower the lid. An hour later, I was headed south on the 395, driving the pickup through the night. I don't know where I'm going yet, but it feels right to be on the move. I'm still not thinking too far ahead. I couldn't stay at Czarnecki's place, so I split. I couldn't leave the kid, so I swapped the Econoline for the old man's truck so I could bring him along. And that's where things stand now. After a few hours, I got off the highway at this truck stop in Bishop. I'm parked facing the Sierras, and the peaks are glowing even though there's no moon out. Patches of snow, bright white against the blue granite and black sky. I wish you could see how pretty it is. I'll rest here in the cab, as I wouldn't be able to sleep in the camper beside the kid. He's my next problem, and I'll have to deal with him soon. Good night, baby. I love you. Today's passage. Don't let fear hold you back from your destiny. Be a hero. Strap on your armor and charge. If you give it your all, there is victory even in failure. Listen, Respond. Win. A New Path to Success by Dr. Christine Pellegrino.
Chapter 16. The only Bob left comes to on his back, the night sky snapping into focus. Half a second earlier, he was 10 years old and swimming in the East River with kids he grew up with, Tommy Boyle treading water and reciting a limerick. There was a young man of Leeds who swallowed a packet of seeds. Great tufts of grass sprouted out of his ass, and his balls were all covered with weeds. But he's back in Arizona now, lying at the bottom of a mountain, a sharp rock poking his liver. The pain when he straightens his broken left arm with his good right one nearly makes him scream. He knew when he jumped the fall wouldn't kill him, but he's pretty sure he got as close to dying as he ever has before. If the fuckers up top came after him now, it'd be all over. He wouldn't be able to fight back. He lifts his head to look around. Nothing but moon rocks and stunted cactus. He tries to hurry the healing by concentrating on where he hurts most. Half an hour later, his bones have knit enough that he can stand. He stomps to test his legs and sets off down the mountain. It's a little after midnight, 5 hours until dawn. He picks up his pace. Town is a long way off. He comes to a trail, follows that until it hits a jeep track, and follows that to pavement, the road back to Phoenix. He walks on the shoulder, ducking when cars pass. Distances out here are deceptive. He sees the lights of a ranch up ahead and figures it'll take 15 minutes to reach it. An hour later, the lights are as far away as ever. His plan was to get back to the motel on his own, but he worries he might have miscalculated, might wind up in the open at sunrise, so when he comes to a crossroads, a four-way stop with a red signal blinking above it, he hides in the scrub and waits. A pickup driving toward Phoenix approaches. Bob steps out in front of it, hands in the air. With his face smeared with dried blood, he's a nightmare come to life. Still, the truck stops. "What's wrong?" the driver asks. "I flipped my bike," Bob replies. He fakes a limp as he moves to the window. The driver is a kid with a flat top and thick glasses. He's wearing white pants and a white shirt with the words Danziger Dairy embroidered on it. "Are you hurt?" the kid says. "I'm banged up, but I'll live," Bob says. "My bike's trash, though. I could use a lift into town." "I'm on my way to work," the kid says. Bob pulls a $20 bill from his pocket. "Drop me at the first payphone." "Keep your money," the kid says. "Getting back." Bob climbs over the tailgate. When he's settled against the cab, the kid hits the gas. The crossroads dwindles until all Bob can make out is the faint red throb of the signal. For the first time since the fight, he thinks of the other Bob. "Rest easy," he tells him. "You will be avenged." The kid stops at a gas station. Bob hops out and walks up to thank him, but he's already pulling away. The station attendant is asleep in the office, head resting on folded arms. Bob goes to the phone booth, gets the number for the Apache Motel from the book, and puts a dime in the slot. The night clerk connects him to Antonia and Elijah's room. Antonia answers. "Bob's dusted," Bob tells her.
"Dusted," she says.
She sounds like she thinks he's joking. "We got ambushed, and he was killed."
"Ambushed by who?
Where?" "I'm not getting into that now." "Are the rest of us in danger?" "I have no fucking idea, but if you are, you'll be better off with me there, so hurry and send someone to pick me up." Elijah and Pedro come for him. They ride back to the motel, and everyone gathers in Antonia and Elijah's room to hear what happened.
"We were at the spot where we were gonna feed," Bob begins. "A rover and an unturned girl tried to snatch the kid, but I caught them at it."
He goes on to tell how the dude stopped his ticker with a lucky poke, and Bob brought him back, but he was still too late to save Bob from getting dusted. He tells how he fought the rover who killed Bob and another who was with him, and was almost dusted himself before escaping by jumping off the mountain. He calls for a smoke when he finishes. Johnny Kickapoo passes a pack of Lucky Strikes. "What happened next?" Antonia says.
"I laid there until I healed, then made my way back here," he says.
"No sign of them on the way?"
"Not hide nor hair."
"Would you know them if you saw them again?"
"The motherfuckers who dusted my best friend and tried real hard to dust me. Yeah, I'd know them."
The fiends are roiling, thirsty for revenge,
ready to ride out and tear the city apart, searching for the lowlifes who killed their compatriot. But it's already 4 a.m., only an hour until daybreak.
"We'll come up with a plan and start hunting as soon as the sun sets tonight," Antonia says.
"I'm not waiting," Bob says. "Who'll lend me a bike?"
"Take mine," Johnny says.
"And I'll ride with you," Pedro says.
"No," Bob says. "I'm going alone." He cruises the strip of seedy motels on East Van Buren, the ones that rent rooms by the hour and show dirty movies on the TVs. There's hardly anyone on the street. A jitterbugging speed freak swatting at imaginary insects. Two alkies grappling under a neon cactus. A cop walking from his patrol car into a diner. No rovers. A dark-haired skeleton wobbling down the sidewalk makes him ease off the throttle. She resembles the girl from the mountain. As he rolls slowly past, she yanks the neck of her t-shirt down to flash her tits, and he sees it's just some whore, some dope fiend. He feels like killing her anyway, feels like watching someone die. Problem is, the sun'll be up before he could do her and get rid of the body. Even so, he pulls over and waits for her to catch up.
"Hey, Daddy," she says.
"Hey, beautiful," he says.
"You looking to party?"
"You looking to die?" The whore recoils.
"Get the fuck out of here, man, before I call a cop," she screeches.
Bob roars off, leaving her spewing curses. He gets back to his room right before daybreak. As he lies down on the bed, the phone rings.
"Any luck?" Elijah says.
"Nope," he replies.
"We'll find them tonight. Don't worry."
Elijah hangs up the phone and pulls the curtains tighter to keep out the rising sun. Antonia is reading on the bed. Her nose is always in a book, which delights Elijah. He views it as something special about her, as he's never in his life known anyone else who read for pleasure. And a long life it's been. He's the oldest of the fiends, born in 1757 in Madrid as Diego Mateo Casal. His father was a wealthy trader and confidant of the king. But all Elijah remembers about growing up is learning to hunt. Boar, deer, mouflon, pheasant. Until he turned, stalking game with a rifle was his greatest passion, and he still finds it funny that a man who once lived to hunt now hunts to live. He eventually went to work for his father, who sent him to New Orleans and put him in charge of the family company's office there. He fell in with a crowd of dissipated expatriates, including a wild, troubled Creole girl, a rover, who introduced him to opium and persuaded him to turn. She killed herself a year later, dashing in the throes of a drug frenzy out of their room and into the sun-blasted courtyard at high noon one day, and he fled New Orleans bereft, disowned, and under suspicion. He changed his name and roamed the growing towns, swelling cities, and endless wildernesses of the new country of America. He met Antonia in Boston in 1842, She was the smartest and most beautiful rover he'd ever encountered, and they've been inseparable ever since. "Bob didn't find the men who attacked them," he says to her.
"Did you think he would?" she replies. "They probably left town right afterward."
"We have to search at least one night if we expect to keep him and the rest in line." "They do love to go on and on about loyalty, don't they?" Antonia says. "One for all and all for one, and how willing they are to die for the gang."
Elijah sits on the bed beside her.
"You used to feel that way too, when we started this thing," he says. "And now most days I wouldn't be comfortable turning my back on a one of them."
"There's another reason we need to find the killers. If word spreads that we let someone get away with dusting one of ours, it'll make us look weak. Weak enough that someone else will take a crack at us. We need to keep people scared. That's what keeps us strong."
"Nobody'd be scared of us if they knew how close the legendary fiends were to coming apart these days, how little it takes to set us at each other's throats."
"Even so, now's not the time to walk away," Elijah says. "The least we owe them is to see this situation through. We've ridden together for a good while."
Antonia scoffs and shakes her head.
"You know what your problem is," she says. "You're tender-hearted."
Elijah tears the book out of her hands and climbs on top of her. He pins her wrists to the mattress and kisses her hard on the mouth.
"Who are you calling tender-hearted?" he says.
Chapter 17
Jesse stops for gas in Flagstaff. He'd like to push on and put more miles between him, Edgar, and Johona, and the fiends. But it's already 3 a.m. They could make Tuba City before sunrise, but would be in trouble if no rooms were available. Better to play it safe and hole up here for the day. "Do you know of a decent motel?" he asks the kid, scrubbing bugs off the windshield of the Grand Prix. "The Spur's down the road," the kid says around a wad of tobacco. "It's cheap and pretty clean." Edgar and Johona return from the station's bathrooms. Edgar asks for change for the candy machine. Jesse tells him to get in the car. Johona yawns and stretches. She's calmed down over the past few hours, had time to think things through. Jesse asks if she's tired. "Bad dreams keep waking me up," she says. "We'll stop here. You'll rest better in a bed." They check into the motel and walk to a diner next door. It has a cowboy theme. Knotty pine paneling, steer horns hanging behind the cash register. The breakfast special is called the Roundup. Jesse, Edgar, and Johona are the only customers. "Out late or up early?" the waitress asks as she pours coffee. "Driving at night to beat the heat," Jesse says. "Good thinking. What can I get you?" Eggs, pancakes, sausage, biscuits. Jesse and the others order more food than they can finish and eat it faster than they should. When Jesse runs out of steam, he sits back and looks out at the empty parking lot and deserted highway. He hates the orange street lights that are replacing the old white ones. They suck the color out of everything and put him in mind of fire. "How far are we from Denver?" Johona says. 10, 11 hours, Jesse says. "We'll have to stop again, probably in Albuquerque." "We'll be passing the res," Johona says. "I've got family on it. My grandma and grandpa, Shimasani and Shiche. I should have you let me off. If any bikers show up out there, my cousins'll beat the shit out of them." She wants to sound tough, but is too tired to be convincing. Chewing her bottom lip, she drags her fork through a puddle of egg yolk. She looks most like Claudine when she's like this, unmasked, unself-conscious. "You speak Navajo?" Jesse asks. "Diné," she says. "The language is called Diné. My mom tried to teach me, but I wasn't into it. I took French instead." "Say something in French, then," Jesse says, not sure he really wants her to, not sure he can handle it. "Je t'aime," she says, and he sees Claudine saying it. "Do you know what that means?" Johona says. "No," Jesse replies, lying. "That's I love you." Edgar opens a jelly packet and slurps the jelly out of it. "Quit," Jesse says, glad to have a distraction. "It's good," Edgar says, sliding him a packet. "Try it." "There's a lady present," Jesse says. "Act like a gentleman." "Forgive me, Miss Johona," Edgar says with a courtly nod. He can't keep it up, starts giggling. Convoy comes on the radio behind the counter, and he sings along. Breaker 19, this here's the rubber duck. Outside, the stars are disappearing one by one. Jesse feels day creeping up. Edgar and Johona get the beds, and Jesse stretches out on the floor with a blanket and pillow. The long night has taken its toll. He falls asleep as soon as he closes his eyes. As a reward for all he's been through, he finds himself walking his desert road again, dreaming his dream. He watches a dust devil whirl, a lizard skitter. He kicks the pop can, chases it, kicks it again. A hawk circles in the sky this time, its shadow crossing and recrossing the road in front of him. "Jesse," a voice calls his name. He looks around. "Jesse." The dream fades, and Johona's crouched beside him. "I'm freaking out," she says. "Come talk to me for a while." He's reluctant. His weakness for her has already led to this, to them running for their lives, and the last thing he needs is something to happen that'll complicate things even further. He has a plan, and he's sticking to it. Drop her at the bus station in Denver and forget her. But then she puts her lips to his ear and whispers, "Please." And his resolve sways and topples. He checks on Edgar, who's snoring quietly, Abby between his legs. Checks the door for the fifth time to make sure it's locked, and climbs onto the bed. He means to keep some space between them, but Johona pulls his arm around her and rests her head on his chest. The weight of her, the smell of her, the warmth triggers so many memories, he's not sure he can bear it.
"You're not lying, are you, about this rover, Jas?" she says.
"You saw that man turn to dust," he replies.
"Maybe it was a trick."
A thin strip of sunlight blazes between the curtain and the window frame.
"Look here," Jesse says, and Johanna lifts her head to watch him stick his finger into the beam.
Her body stiffens, and she wrinkles her nose at the stink of burning flesh. Jesse shows her the charred finger, and she stares wide-eyed as it heals. When it's good as new, she takes hold of it and examines it closely.
"That's so fucking weird," she says, reaching for her cigarettes.
"So, how old are you, really?"
"I was born August 30th, 1876, Jesse says.
"Edgar was born on the 8th of December, 1883.
"You've lived through so much stuff."
"I've been too busy looking after Edgar to pay much attention."
"It's been 100 years. Everything's changed. There's cars, airplanes, TV."
"Yeah, but people are the same. Still lying, still thieving, still killing each other."
Johanna strikes a match and puts it to a smoke.
"There's a preacher who says the world is ending next year," she says.
"There's always a preacher saying that," Jesse says.
"Don't listen."
"You're cynical. It's because you're a Virgo. Don't listen to that crap either."
Two men walk past the window, arguing about whether the liquor store is open yet and how much beer to buy. Edgar rolls over, and Abby climbs onto his back and licks a paw.
"What about Claudine?" Johanna says.
Jesse tenses.
"What about her?
Was she a rover, too?"
"She was."
"And it's been how long since you last saw her?"
72 years, Jesse says.
Someone flushes the toilet in the next room and falls back into bed. The headboard bangs the wall. Johanna crosses her legs and balances an ashtray on her knee, sits there smoking and thinking things over.
"Do you know where she is now?"
she says.
"She's dead," Jesse says.
He'd planned to leave it at that, but once he starts talking, he can't stop. He and Claudine hit the road after she turned him, and he saw more of the world than he ever dreamed he would. Along the way, she taught him how to survive as a rover, how to hunt, who to feed on, when to hunker down, when to run. After 4 years together, his love for her burned as hot as it had in the beginning. He never once regretted turning, never once pined for his old life. In the summer of 04, short of money, they rejoined the carnival Claudine was with when they met. The owner's daughter was a rover, and the show was a refuge for her and others who'd turned. Claudine ran her fortune-telling racket, and Jesse worked as a roustabout. They'd been with the caravan 2 months when it set up in Hot Springs, Arkansas. Claudine needed to feed, but was trying to hold off until they got to a bigger town, where hunting would be easier and safer. Their second night in Hot Springs, though, potential prey caught her eye. A drunk in overalls and muddy boots who'd been bum-rushed from the hoochie-coochie tent for spitting at one of the dancers. Claudine resolved to stalk this drunk and take him if the opportunity arose. Jesse told her it was too risky, but she wouldn't be swayed. She'd misjudged her hunger and couldn't wait any longer.
"All right then," Jesse said, but he was going with her.
They slipped away from the carnival and found the drunk pissing against a tree. He staggered and sang and argued with himself as they trailed him. The moon turned everything either bone white or blackest black. They'd walked about a mile when the drunk swerved off the main road onto a narrow, overgrown trail that sloped downward through a thick wood where the treetops meshed overhead to form a tunnel. Barely any moonlight penetrated this canopy, just enough to speckle the ground. Jesse offered to bring the man down for Claudine, but she drew her knife and trotted off to make the kill herself. Swiftly, silently, she gained on the drunk, catching up to him in a small, bright clearing. Everything was going as it was supposed to until a branch snapped under her foot as she raised her knife, and the man whirled and dodged her strike.
"Help!" he bellowed. "Help!"
Claudine jumped onto his back, and his shout died in a gurgle when she cut his throat. She rode him to the ground and fastened her mouth to the spurting wound. He struggled, but in her bloodlust, her strength more than matched his. Footsteps approached from farther down the trail, and someone shouted,
"Jim, sing out, boy!"
3 other men stepped into the clearing with lanterns and shotguns.
"What in the hell? She's killed Jim."
Claudine sprang to her feet, and a shotgun boomed. Jesse caught a glimpse of her in midair in the muzzle flash. Buckshot tore through her, nearly cutting her in half.
She dropped to the ground, and Jesse ran to her. The other men fired. One blast shredded Jesse's left arm. The other struck him full in the chest. After an instant of scalding pain, he lost consciousness. He stops here, can go no further.
"I couldn't do anything to save her," he says.
"I'm sorry," Johanna says. "I won't ask you about her again." Jesse manages to get back to sleep, this time dreamlessly. He has no idea how long he's been out when the sound of the door being unlocked makes him sit up as awake as if he'd never closed his eyes. Johanna is fumbling with the security chain. The sun is still shining.
"I'm going to get something to eat," she says. "We have to lay low," Jesse says. "The fiends. I thought you said they can't be out in the daytime. I'm just going for Fritos and a Coke. There's candy on the table and some jerky. I need cigarettes, too."
Jesse hesitates, unsure whether to push it.
"I'll be back in 5 seconds," Johanna says.
She opens the door and takes care to block the sun with her body as she squeezes through it. As soon as she's gone, Jesse kicks himself for letting her go, worried he's put too much trust in her. He paces the room, thinking of all the ways she might betray him. His anxiety turns to relief when she taps at the door 10 minutes later and says,
"It's me.
I got you these," she says, and hands him a pair of mirrored sunglasses.
"What do you expect I'm going to do with them?" he says. "Some people wear them at night."
He slips the glasses on.
"Check you out," Johanna says. "Joe Cool."
"Joe Cool," Jesse says. "Okay, then." They lie on the bed, and Johanna tells him about growing up in Phoenix, chattering away until she dozes off in the middle of a story. He curls around her and buries his nose in her hair. He shouldn't have gone back to the bowling alley. Shouldn't have taken her out afterward. Her resemblance to Claudine clouded his judgment, and now here they are in a world of trouble with the fiends. He recalls the threat the biker made before he jumped, and the story of the stolen motorcycle and similar savage tales he's heard, and knows that even if he puts Johanna on a bus to Los Angeles, she'll never be completely safe. And neither will he and Edgar. They'll always be looking over their shoulders, worried the fiends will catch up to them. And one night they will.
Maybe there's another way, though. An alternative to running and hiding that he's too scattered and too panicky to see. What he needs to do is talk to someone with a clearer head. Someone who can look at the mess he's made and help him devise a plan to get out of it. What he needs to do is call Beaumont.
Monsieur Amadou Beaumont was born in Africa and turned there, too. He claims to have met Jesus Christ, Attila the Hun, and William Shakespeare, to have lived in various countries that don't exist anymore, and to speak 3 forgotten languages. He's also acknowledged to be the oldest rover in existence, making him a respected figure among the turned. Hoping to benefit from his experience and wisdom, rovers seek him out for advice, regarding him as a mentor, judge, and sage. Claudine introduced Jesse to him in St. Louis in 1903, a year before she died. She and Beaumont had traveled around Europe together before she came to the U.S., and after listening to the two of them wax rapturous about their adventures, Jesse suspected they'd been lovers. He asked Claudine if this was so, but all she did was make a joke, saying,
"How dare you? Don't you know you're the first man I've ever been with?"
What's true is that when Jesse next saw Beaumont, this time in New Orleans in 1920 or thereabouts, and informed him that Claudine had been dusted, the man wept like a child. He and Edgar visited him on a couple of occasions after that, the last time being 20 years ago when passing through Las Vegas, where Beaumont had been living for a while. They met at a bar, and Beaumont spent the entire evening reminiscing about Claudine, bursting into tears once again as he described her dancing on a beach in Spain. His recollections kicked open the door to Jesse's own past, and for months afterward he was tormented by memories of Claudine. Unwilling to risk such anguish again, he hasn't contacted the man since. Now, though, he needs his guidance. He leaves the room.